So we were very lucky to get the entire story on videotape before this medical condition, you know, began to hamper his ability to communicate. But what's very interesting to me is I took this video interview that Ruben, my co-author, did, and I transcribed it on paper, word for word, and I compared it with the transcription of, or the transcribed version of a testimony that Mr. Shrum gave in 1964 to an investigator from NICAP, the National Investigation Committee on Aerial Phenomenon. And even though that was 1964 and this one was like 2005, the descriptions, the way he described things, the descriptions of the entities, the descriptions of the ships matched 100%. So, I mean, it is burned or engraved in his memory, the events that happened that night. So then something very strange happened to moving the story along. The second type of being, which appeared more mechanical than organic, suddenly he moved right to the base of the tree where Mr. Shrum was, and the hand seemed to reach for some kind of mechanism around the mouth, what we would consider the mouth area. And then a jet of gas, some kind of vapor, shot upward and started drifting up into the tree where Mr. Shrum was located.
Then he come down up on the rock. He was about 7 feet from me. And then he touched his mouth, and kind of a steam vapor come out of his mouth, and it lit up his face so I could see some detail. And then I blacked out when that steam hit me, or I guess it was kind of took the air from me, and I'd gasp for air and then black out, and I fell over my bow. That's the only thing that kept me in the tree. And then, so I figured they were out to get me then.
So, given that these strange visitors had made their first, what you would interpret as a hostile move, they were obviously trying to get at him, or that's how he interpreted it. He suddenly, you know, became very, very much into a survival mode of thinking. And he was, you know, from then on and for the next approximately 12 hours, he was locked in the mode of surviving this somehow, some way, so he could get back to his family, to his wife, to his young daughter. And really the only kind of weapons that he had at his disposal was his bow and three arrows is all he had remaining. So this was a, you know, these guys obviously had a technology beyond what was available on Earth in 1964, and he was there with the most primitive of weapons, which was a bow and arrow. And we've actually talked to people who hold the theory that if the Earth is ever invaded by a higher, more advanced species, going low-tech might actually be a way to cause significant damage to this technologically superior race that would try to take over the Earth. So, you know, hiding out, using guerrilla tactics, hiding underground, using the lowest technology possible to fight back, some people feel would be the most effective means of combating invading aliens. Well, Mr. Shrum didn't have any choice in the matter. All he had at his disposal was low tech. So he shot his arrows, as we'll hear in this next clip.
So I had a 60-pound bow, which is a very high velocity. And I shot seeing how the robot's the only thing that was causing me harm, I shot the chest area, and it has the velocity of a rifle at that distance, because I'm only about 7-8 feet from him. And it, when I hit the chest, the sparks would fly like electrical, like an arc welder, kind of. And then that robot backed up and almost knocked him down. He kind of fell back against a rock. And the two at the bottom took off and headed for the brush and stood out there about 30 feet from me. And then I shot two more arrows, and about the same time sequence that these two humanoids would, every time I'd shoot, they'd go back up into the brush, just almost out of sight from me.
So he was, you know, kind of causing them some confusion or frustration temporarily, but there wasn't any damage, of course, that was being done by his crude weapons. So basically, the onslaught would continue for many hours more. This is the actual bow that Mr. Shrum used in the incident. He showed some of the artifacts from his encounter. He showed them to Ruben during the interviews that we did. So, having expended his three arrows, his only choice now was to, you know, use whatever means at his disposal. He was trying to think of every possible means to at least slow down the attack on him, the attempts to grab him out of the tree. And one of the things he thought to do, because he had a lot of matches, as a hunter, he always carried lots of matches. He thought about setting branches from the tree on fire and throwing them down. He thought about lighting parts of his clothing on fire and throwing it down, and hopefully catch some of the vegetation around the base of the tree on fire. And maybe, you know, something that had happened earlier during the initial approach of the aliens kind of gave him the idea that perhaps they might be afraid of fire. So he attempted to do this.
Then I ran out of arrows, so I only had three left, and I thought, well, that's when pomade hair is just, I mean, the cap I had on was just soaked with oil.
This is for your hair?
Yeah, from my hair, yeah, pomade. And I always carried all kinds of books of matches with me when I hunted. And so I lit that cap, and it just blazed up, and I dropped it down the base of the tree. And just in that instant, they moved back about 12, 15 feet, and I glanced over at the ship that was over the canyon, kind of almost level with me, and it was almost out of sight. It was just like a star. It moved that fast.
Wow.
Just in that second. So then I got the idea that they're scared of fire. So I burned everything but my t-shirt and my jeans, and come to find out later on that it was 32 degrees out, and I was shaking and kind of overexposed for the weather. And I had a bunch of change, and I threw it down, and they all kind of gathered around it. Well, after I shot my or started burning stuff and throwing it down, and I even tied some of my shirt that I ripped up to a compass so I could try to hit some brush, because there wasn't nothing right underneath the tree. and in I caught a little pile of brush on fire. I figured that would bring the cavalry. That when I run out of stuff to burn, I headed for the top of the tree, and then it was a pretty sparse tree. I could see down to the ground, and I broke off the top and threw it down. And anytime I throw down or shake the tree, these humanoids would back up.
Okay, so the fire was causing these strange entities to back away for a while, but then they would come right back, and they would continue this process of trying to gas him and apparently bring him down from the tree. So here's some sketches done by the eyewitness. As you can see, the size, shape of the two entities that he saw are very similar. This was the entity that he refers to as being a humanoid, and then this is the entity he describes as being a robot or robotic. So once again, we're not clear if this was two different types of beings or simply two different suits or two different clothing types. Okay, and this was the initial sketch. This was one of the later sketches of the scene that Mr. Shrum did. This is the tree, and that's his representation of himself holding the bow and arrow, the large ship hovering over the ravine. And what's very interesting in talking to Mr. Shrum is he heard a series of strange noises. He at first thought it was bird song. He thought it was maybe owls or other kinds of night birds. But then after a while, he began to notice that when he heard the sound, shortly afterward, the entities would do something different. They would change their course of action. Like, for example, the sounds would happen and then the two humanoids would attempt to climb the tree, and he'd have to kick at them and throw stuff down, throw pieces of the tree at them, shake the tree to try to get them from not being able to climb up. So after a while, he thought, and in thinking about it since, he thinks that perhaps this was a method of communication between the entities. And this is what he says in this clip.
Did you hear any noise between them? Any communication? Was there any?
You know, I heard kind of a cooing or almost like an owl. But it could have been an owl, you know, that up there. But it just kind of fit in with them.
So when you heard this owl-like sound, what did they do?
Well, they'd go on about their business, you know, what they were. But they would try to climb up the tree. They're trying to boost each other up the tree, and when I would, that's why I know I wasn't out very long at a time, because when I'd throw something down or when I was being gassed, they'd step back from the tree, and then they'd be, when I'd come to, I'd have dry heaves and kind of gas for air, and they'd just be trying to climb back up on the tree. So that gave me a time that I wasn't out very long.
Okay, so the story is getting near its conclusion now. Mr. Shrum was locked in this ordeal for hours. The creatures would try different methods to try to get to him in the tree. He would resist them. He would kick at them. He would throw stuff at them. They would attempt to gas him with some kind of vapor that dispelled all the oxygen from the air and caused him to black out temporarily. So all these methods were being tried. And he was convinced, he is to this day, you know, we've been on talk shows, And callers have called in saying, well, maybe he misunderstood these beings' motives. Maybe they were actually friendly and just, well, Mr. Shrum is very, very much convinced that his life was in peril. And if he did not succeed in overcoming this challenge, he would never see his family again. There was this overwhelming feeling that he was, that his life as he knew it was about to expire unless he was able to somehow survive this night. So this went on, you know, as I say, all night. And then something really unusual happened. There was a totally new strategy on the part of the entities, as we're going to hear in this clip.
After I went to the top of the tree, I had a military belt, and I moved it out to the last hitch and put it around me and the tree. So in case I did get gassed, they wouldn't I wouldn't fall down. And then, like I said, I threw chains down and everything to try to distract them. And then finally, they these two humanoids stepped back from the tree, and another robot came, and there was two just about the same place that the two humanoids were. And this, they stood facing each other, and the flames, just like lightning, and it real bright, and it just came between them. And then the gas was so thick coming up the tree that it would dissipate just about the time I got to me. But then that's when I'd start to gasp for air. And then when I woke up from that, it was light, but the sun hadn't come up yet. And I was just hanging by my belt, my head down, my feet down, and they were gone. Well, I knew I made it. I lived through the night.
Just to go back. Did you fall asleep, or this gas? Did it overwhelm you?
Yeah, that's when it completely engulfed the whole tree and got up to me. And I don't know how long I was out, but it was just you could see just a dim glow of the sun in the on the clouds and stuff, not clouds, but in the sky. And then when I woke up, it was light, but the sun hadn't come up yet.
So he was just hanging from the tree by his military belt. Mr. Shrum told us that for years he worried that after this final gassing, when he passed out for the last time, from that time until he awoke, he didn't know what had happened or how long that period of time was. He didn't know if perhaps they had actually gotten to him and done something to him, maybe even removed him from the tree, done things, and then brought him back and placed him back in his original position. He was very concerned about that. Until a few years later, Paul Cerny, the lead investigator in this case for NICAP, suggested that he undergo regressive hypnotherapy. And through hypnotherapy, Mr. Shrum, it was established that following this last blackout, the beings never reached him. He remembered other interesting details that he hadn't, in his fully conscious mind, had never been able to bring forth. But under hypnotherapy, he remembered small details like the massive size of the mothership, 150 feet in diameter. Also, he remembered that there were what looked like footsteps. It looked like a child wearing moccasin the type of footsteps that would be made by a child wearing moccasins all around the base of the tree after he got down, you know. But anyway, through the hypnotherapy sessions, he became convinced in his own mind that he had never been reached by the entities. So this was the original sketch, by the way, that Mr. Shrum did right after the incident. It's a very unique story. It's unlike any other that I had ever heard of. It has a lot of interesting little nuances and details that would indicate that someone like Mr. Shrum would just not make something like this up out of nowhere, you know, just because he was interested in telling a yarn or something. He wasn't that kind of person. And Vincent Alvarez gave written testimony that he saw the initial entry into the area of the 150-foot-wide mothership. And as I stated earlier, Tim Trueblood, the other gentleman, this is Mr. Trueblood, this is Mr. Alvarez, this is what Mr. Shrum looked like back then. Mr. Trueblood never gave us a formal statement. And then there was the Air Force. The Air Force came. Air Force officers were dispatched to talk to Mr. Shrum. He thought they were from the local base. Later, when NICAP and MUFON did some searching, it turned out they had been sent to him from Wright-Patterson Air Force Base near Dayton, Ohio, which many people say was a hotbed of government UFO activities in the 1960s. So they came all the way from Ohio to interview Mr. Shrum, but they weren't really there to collect data. They were actually there to discourage him from taking the belief that this was anything strange or out of the ordinary. They were trying to convince him that, for example, they floated a lot of scenarios to him, that maybe it was a Boy Scout troop that was out in the forest, and they were just having fun with him, you know, playing a prank with him. And then they said, you know, maybe it was some Japanese prisoners of war that had gotten loose and are still living out there in the forests all these years. And all kinds of bizarre explanations they attempted to plant in his brain. We're going to hear just a short clip about that. Well, that one's not triggering, so let me see if I can click on it. Well, but basically that's what he had to say. I think my slideshow is okay. All right. Well, I'm going to take a few questions. We don't have a great deal of time. It's a very interesting case, one of the best cases that I personally have run across. It's one that's not very well known because Mr. Shrum refused to have his actual name used all those years because he was fearful, and it is only until recently that he disclosed full details and the names of everybody involved. So this, you know, because it was anonymous, a lot of people didn't take it seriously, but then when you go back and do the research and find that it was a legitimate case investigated by many of the top UFO researchers of that era, then you realize this was an amazing event. So, and Mrs. Shrum, who did the foreword to our book, Aliens in the Forest, unfortunately passed away just a few months ago. And we were very sorry. She helped us tremendously she wanted to, before she passed out, she was suffering with a long bout, of cancer. And she wanted, before she passed away, that the true story of her husband's experience go out to the world. So I remember her son took pictures of the day the boxes of our book arrived at their house. We sent them a box full of complimentary copies. And her face was just so lit up in those pictures. And that was just a few weeks before she passed away. So anyone have questions? I can take just a couple about this strange incident or anything at all that you'd like to ask or comment about. Yes, ma'am. Yes, if I hadn't run out of time, there's a whole nother part, what you can read about in Aliens in the Forest, about the investigation the fact that there was clear evidence that after these Wright-Patterson investigators came to talk to Mr. Shrum, the Air Force actually went out there and they found evidence. They went out there to the scene and did a thorough investigation, and they raked the ground for a large diameter distance all around the base of that tree that Mr. Shrum was in. So they did as thorough of a job as possible of collecting all the scraps of any possible evidence. So Mr. Shrum was asking if they were trying to do so hard to discredit my story and tell me that what I experienced was nothing out of the ordinary, why did they send an entire task force out to where this happened to clean up the scene? You know, that's one thing that he never understood. And there's a lot more to it. There was many more investigations by NICAP and MUFON and a lot of interesting stuff. Yes, another question. The question is, could this encounter have been somehow linked to their employment with the missile defense contractor, Aerojet? Maybe they were trying to find out what telepathically or linking to their minds what kind of missile and rocket systems Mr. Shrum was involved in. Yeah, that's a very good thought, and that's not a question that that ever came up in our conversations, but it's intriguing because of the fact that it happened there and the people involved in it were all Aerojet employees. Yes, very good question. One more back there, sir. Yeah, hypnotherapy. Yeah, there are pros and cons, and you have to have someone who's certified, who's a medically trained person. It can't be just Joe, who belongs to the Mutual UFO Network, who's conducting this because he read how to do it on the internet, you know. But these were all highly credentialed people that were involved in Mr. Shrum. And really, the hypnotherapy that was done on Mr. Shrum did not disclose any earth-shattering new information. Everything that I told you today came out of his sworn testimony given right after the event and then revisited by us many years later. The only thing that came out of the hypnotherapy with Mr. Shrum was that he himself, within himself, he developed a sense of peace. He developed the realization that the aliens never got to him. That's really the only thing. That there was no additional details or information that could have been suggested to him, because the testimony had already been given and had been written down by NICAP. So there was no additional details other than a couple of things, the footprints and the size of the ship. One last question, and then we have to make way for Mr. Stanton Friedman. Yes, sir. Yes, all three of the men split up. One of them made it back to base camp. The other one found a shelter of some kind in a rocky area. And so they didn't get back together until the following day. And I really didn't have time to delve into what happened the morning after the encounter, but it's all in the book if you are interested in getting that. Thank you very much. You've been a great audience.
Thank you.